On Before the Bestseller, we talk with our favorite authors about the books they wrote and the stories behind how those books made it big. I'm your host, Alex Straffy, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you here today. My guest today is the author of Don't Believe Everything You Think. He has just crossed over 5,000 Amazon ratings and has sold over 200,000 copies. This book is a breakout sensation, which has only been on the market since 2022. And you can tell just how beautifully it's written by how well it's selling. The author has been able to remove a lot of complication around the concept of thoughts. And one of my favorite quotes, my apologies to whoever said it because I don't remember who it's attributed to, but it's essentially, perfection is not when things can be added, but when there's nothing left to be removed. And that is the essence of this book. And so I am very excited to dive into the topic. It's a topic that fascinates me as a recovering self-help junkie, being able to speak with a self-help author at the forefront of his niche and hear about what he's doing differently to hopefully change the self-help junkie mindset. And then also he's going to come back on next time and talk about how he's gotten the book to sell so well. So welcome on the show, Joseph.
Joseph, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and chat about your book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, which have my copy right here. It is a topic that has, I think for some of us overthinkers, which after reading the book, seems like you started off as one of those overthinkers as well. Some of us, I think, are cursed with a extra conscious mind. And there's a lot of pain and work that has to be done to sort of overcome and learn how to think, because, you know, it's one of those things they don't teach you in high school, kind of like taxes, that would be a lot more useful than, you know, some other classes that they teach us in high school. So I appreciate you taking the time to come on, talk about your book, and then come on next time and talk about the marketing.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation. It's always an honor to be able to be invited to things like this. And you have a great platform and you're doing amazing work for a lot of other authors too, because it's definitely difficult to be able to share your work with the world. It's hard enough to write it, let alone bring it out into existence, into the external world. So yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure. And of someone who is so good at their craft, it's going to be really insightful to learn how you've developed a book that really seems to spread so well through word of mouth. So first question everyone gets is a childhood story that made you who you are today.
Childhood story. I would say this one's very interesting because it's more about what didn't happen than what did, if that makes sense. Growing up, my parents came over from Vietnam, so they were immigrants. My dad was, well, once the Vietnam fell to the communists, they had a couple of years to get out, and my dad had to either fight for the communists or escape. That was his only two options. Wow. And so if he stayed, he would also have to give up his religion because he was Catholic, and he still is. So he left in a heartbeat. It wasn't even a decision, really. He just got on a boat, like a little dinghy. It was not bigger than a living room, and it had about like 100 people, and more than half of the people did not survive on that dinghy. And then I think he landed in Thailand after a week with no food, no water. And that was very formative for him. And I think just hearing that story and knowing what he had to go through and seeing how he lives over here, that's definitely been a huge impact on me. And I just see how he navigates. And so growing up, I knew why he had to work so much. He wasn't home that often. He was working like just from morning. I wouldn't even see him in the morning. And then I would barely be able to see him at night. So that was most of the childhood. Yes, on the weekends, we would be able to hang out and things like that. But mostly my parents were working all the time. And so I had to really take care of myself and my little brother from a very early age. So just whatever, finding frozen food, cooking that, and just surviving basically. And I didn't really feel a huge lack from that until later on, but I understood why that happened. So it didn't really, I don't have trauma per se from that, but that shaped who I am, if that makes sense, by kind of forcing me to understand adults, what they had to go through, and not really think about myself as often and be like, hey, like I want to play with my parents, or like, that didn't really cross my mind. It was just, they're working, I'm here, that's it. So from a very young age, I became very cognizant of these things. And I think that's why I've always been quite mindful, or at least just being able to have a deeper understanding of the world than just whatever my temporal needs are in the present moment. So that's really how I grew up. And my parents, well, it wasn't easy over here either. They went into like $1 million worth of debt, because my dad kind of like lost a lot of things within the 08 crash over here. So from that, I understood that there was a lot of stress, just money-wise, financially. So that took a huge toll on my parents, and then I just saw that with me. I didn't feel like I was dirt broke growing up. I just never asked for anything. So it wasn't like I felt that much lack, but I understood the effects that it had on my parents and them either arguing about money or whatever it was. I understood that there were a lot of constraints with their life because of that money that wasn't there. So I just saw all of that, and that's what formed me into who I am now. And yeah, that's kind of like what I remember most from my childhood is like just being very, very observant of these things. But not really judging, not really blaming, not really doing any of those sort of things, but just, I guess, being okay and more so accepting everything as it is and helping my parents where I could. And so after I left high school, I saw that they weren't going to pay off their debt. So I just took it upon myself to leave college, because I knew I wasn't going to be able to help them pay off the debt if I was just making 35 grand a year with 50 grand worth of college debt, or, you know, that type of thing. So then I left and then helped my mom grow her business, which is a bridal store. So I learned how to run ads, do a lot of marketing, things like that. And so I only made that decision because I saw what they had to go through and what they didn't have. And I was like, this is no way to live. And like, they're going to die in so much debt after escaping their home country to a bunch of communists. I didn't feel like that was the life that they deserved. So I feel like I had a lot of motivation to make something happen for not just me, but for my parents, really. And then, yeah, now my parents are doing fantastic. They almost paid off all the debt, and my parents have more than enough money to survive for a really long time. So yeah, they don't have to worry about a retirement plan. They didn't have one, but after all this time and helping them out and helping them grow everything, like, yeah, they have generational wealth now, which is nice.
They must be so grateful for you. And I can already tell that the next 20 minutes is not going to be enough time for this conversation, kicking it off like that. that's incredibly profound, it sounds like. And for you to take that in stride see it the way you did is a very interesting thing to be doing at that, you know, as a kid, to be kind of analyzing it the way that you did. And yeah, I can see, you know, some of us, you know, are like, you know, complain about our parents, but when you look back and you're like, yeah, my dad, you know, escaped communism on a dinghy.
Yeah.
floating on the ocean, you know.
It's like, how can you blame them? You can't. They all did. Every single parent did what they could with what they had, with what they knew. Yeah. If they knew better, they would have done better, of course.
Yeah.
So it's like kind of realizing that and seeing that, oh, they are human. They have a lot of flaws. And, oh, maybe, like, how can I actually help them versus how are they supposed to help me? And yeah, what they should have done, and all these things. It's just like, I see them as friends versus a parental figure or anything like that. I don't expect anything from anyone anymore because of this. And I understand that now. So that's helped a lot with navigating life and not getting so frustrated with everyone.
So I know it sounds like probably helping with your mom's business and also just the awakening that sort of a growing up provided you with probably led you to who you are today. But how did, you know, the Joseph that we know as the very successful author, how did you become the successful author that we all know today?
That's a great question. So first, I would define what success is to me personally, because success is a very vague and ambiguous term.
5,000 plus Amazon ratings is a good start.
Yeah, that's a good measure of external success. But I would say all external success comes from internal success. And internal success for me is very different than what I see on the outside. So I defined, before I even wrote the book, what success meant to me. And I think that's the main reason why it even went there in the first place. Success to me is being able to do what I love and share that with the world. That's it. That is the most basic and fundamental form of success for me. And if I get to do that today, then today is successful. But you can probably see how having that specific perspective on it really creates a powerful compounding effect in a positive direction instead of the inverse. Because if I put success in an external sense, let's say I said it's 10,000 reviews instead of 5,000, I'm not successful yet, which will lead me to start thinking negatively about myself or saying I'm not enough or I need to do more or all these things, right? Or compare myself to other authors or think that my book isn't good enough and that's why it's not there. But all of that is completely unnecessary. Thinking negatively about myself or my work or whatever, like that has absolutely no utility. So what I did was I defined success in a way for me that I could feel that way in the present moment, regardless of any external circumstances. If everyone took everything away from me and I had no measure or quantifiable way of success, how could I feel that way now? Because that will lead to external success. Inputs create outputs. Everything external is created from the internal. And that's how our thoughts create our reality. And so that's why I define success as being able to do what I love now and share it with the world to any degree. It doesn't mean I have to sit there and be able to write all day. That's a arbitrary and not helpful way to define success either. It's, can I do it at all today to any degree? So if I can sit there and write for 5 minutes, that's success to me for that day. And maybe the next day I can do 10, 15, and maybe in a year I can do a couple hours. So that's how I've defined it. And that's been probably the biggest shift personally that created the external results that you see. And I define success for my book as not how many people like it, if what the review ratings are, if it's above a 4.5 or whatever it is, because I can't control the reviews. I really can't. Yes, I can control what I put in the book to get those reviews. But again, not everyone's going to like the book and every negative review is going to impact me very, very immensely if I put too much weight on it. So I measured the book success by if I like it myself and if it's helpful for me. Was it a true expression of my own self or not? And it was. So even if the book got like a 2-star rating or whatever it is, or it didn't sell anything, that wouldn't really matter to me. I would keep writing regardless of that. Yeah. And maybe the other books will take off, cool, but that really wasn't the initial goal. It was really for me. And that's how I was able to control my own feeling of success, which then led to the external.
These are very believable answers after reading the book. So this is very not expected, but it's in line with what you write about. So about the book, why do we think and how do we stop it?
So,
and why should we?
Yeah. So at a biological level, we think in order to process so that we can survive. That's it. It's a survival tool. Just like how we have fear, we have our emotions, we have all these sorts of senses. All our five senses are geared towards survival. For most of our existence, for as long as Homo sapiens existed, everything we were trying to do was just to survive today. Nowadays, we don't have to fight tooth and nail to be able to survive. It's a lot easier. Not saying it's easy, but it's significantly easier than trying to hunt down our own food and hunt and gather and all these sorts of things. So from an evolutionary perspective, it was very, very helpful to think, to be able to predict in the future, am I going to die if I eat this or if I go here or touch this thing? Nowadays, we're doing that without actually being in danger. Yes, if we're in the wild, we need those tools. We need to think of the past and, okay, what did I do last time that really harmed me? And think about now and then also in the future. But how many times are we actually in danger where our lives are at stake? Most of the time, it's not. I would say 80 to 90% of the time, or even higher, right? Unless you're living in a really bad neighborhood. But most of the time, we're not fending for our lives, but we act like we are. And that's what the thinking does. It uses past experiences to try to predict a future so that we can have a higher chance to survive. Where it's not helpful is where it will cause thinking will cause fear, anxiety, depression, and all of these sorts of things. It will use our past traumas from our childhood and project it out into the future and say, it's always going to be like this. Because I was never loved as a child, I will never find love and never be loved, and I'll die alone. So you can start to see how that creates a very, very dangerous picture for ourselves. And it really ruins our self-image, our confidence, our peace, our joy. And that's why, and this all comes down to a very simple thing. All fear, anxiety, depression, all these sorts of things, yes, they came from our childhood, but it's from our thinking about our childhood. So I kind of break this down into a couple of different ways. It's not the event that happens in our lives, but how we think about them that creates how we feel. And it seems like it can't be true, but then when you look at it from a different perspective and all these different people, there are a lot of people who have gone through a lot of trauma. And many of them have gone through the same thing. But how is it possible that different people have different outcomes if they have gone through the same experiences? Lived in the same neighborhood, same house, or whatever. You can see it in siblings too. So that means that it can't only be the event that dictates our lives. And that's when our thinking comes in. Different people, so let's say there's like a victim mentality and then kind of like a responsible or someone that takes responsibility for their actions, right? There's those two different types of personas. The one that is a victim will kind of say, this happened to me, I can't change anything, that's how it's going to be. The other mentality is taking responsibility for it. Okay, let's say, yes, it's not my fault that happened, but I am responsible for what I think about it and how I feel. So they will see those things as either neutral events, they just happened. Yes, it's unfortunate, but I'm not going to let that dictate my life anymore. So they change their thinking. And that's a very great way. I think that's like CBT, like cognitive behavioral therapy. They kind of like reframe a lot of these things. There's another layer deeper that you can go beyond that, which is completely letting go of what you think about any event. So that's like crazy because that strips the conditioning of anything that happens. And this is very powerful because you see reality as it is instead of how you see it is. It removes the personal judgment from any situation. So let's say it's raining outside. Some people will say, this sucks. This ruined my day, whatever it is. But the actual event that happened is neutral. It's raining. That's it. That's what I mean by removing the story behind it. The story creates the suffering. And the story comes from our own thinking. Without the story, there is no suffering. There's just rain. There's just, my parents worked all the time. That's the actual event that happened. But the story says, my parents didn't love me. Or my parents didn't love me enough to stay home. Or they don't approve of me. All these different things. And the story is, I'm not enough. I'm not lovable. I'm not good. All those sorts of things. Those are all stories, but they're not helpful stories. And we can't change the event, but we can always change the story. Or better yet, let go of the story entirely and not need a story. So that's kind of the next evolution of peace, I would say, is just not needing any sort of thinking involved with that specific thing. One question I'd really love to ask to kind of help bring this point home is, when you are very, very stressed and overwhelmed, how much thinking is going on? A lot. It's a lot of thinking.
Endless.
Yeah. But when you're at peace, how much thinking is going on?
Not much.
That's the key.
Yeah.
And it all comes back down to that. That is all there is. And we can overcomplicate it, but it doesn't help. And so I've really boiled it down to that simple, simple, simple truth. Yeah. That when we think just way too much, we suffer. And there's a direct correlation with that. But the inverse is also true. The less we think, the less we suffer.
Yeah. And I really love, I've read a lot of self-help books. I'm a self-help junkie by, and I actually swore off them like two years ago.
Oh,
every single one of them made me, I'd read it. I'd be like, oh my God, this is the truth in the world. And then a month later I would be in a worse position and feel even worse about myself.
Yep.
And I do like, the simplicity, you know, and there's that saying that's, you know, perfection isn't when there's, you know, more, nothing left to add, but when there's nothing left to take away. Right. And your book is very simple and does a great job at communicating the concepts very, very well. Specifically, you have the The very actionable area of the goal. You know, the goal isn't just to stop thinking, it's to spend more time in practice of not thinking so that you just spend less of your day thinking, which is more practical than just saying, well, I'll just stop thinking, right?
Right.
But, you know, one of my biggest beefs with the self-help genre is the fact that some people just actually have mental health issues, diseases, right? So like, for example, I suffer extensively from intrusive thoughts and OCD. I see a therapist, do ERP. It's helped tremendously, much better person, or my mental health state is phenomenal today compared to where it was a couple of years ago. But I think about that version of myself that was just bent on fixing himself through self-help books when what I really needed was a professional. So how do you see the difference between, or what would you say to someone, or what's the difference between someone who could really benefit from a book like this and someone who should just go get professional help? And I know you've seen therapists as well.
Yes. So
I know it's, you're not just someone who's like,
no,
about the stuff. You really have, you know, explored mental health to its fullest. So yeah, I would love to hear how you do that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's different for every person, but it can't hurt to get help from a professional or someone else. There are professionals that aren't great.
Oh my God. Course, yeah. For every good therapist, there's like 10 bad ones.
Yeah. So it's like, and I've heard of horror stories where it can hurt. So like,
yeah,
there is no right or wrong answer.
That's fair. Yeah. Therapy can, if it's a bad therapist, it could hurt as much as, you know. Yeah. So that's a really good point, I suppose. I guess my point is like, you know, if, let's say someone has clinical depression and they're like, oh, I just want a book to make me happy. When it's like, actually, they just have a lack of, you know, serotonin in their brain or whatever happened.
Yeah.
You know? How do you sort of navigate those waters?
Yeah. So this is where it becomes very personal and not a blanket statement where I can just say, this is what you need to do. My book is very much the same way, where it doesn't say, this is what you need to do.
Yeah.
My book always points back to, what do you need personally? Ask yourself, what do you need? What do you feel like you need? Do you feel like you need more guidance? Do you feel like you need more handholding? Or do you feel like you just need to sit there with yourself and write out your thoughts, your feelings, and really work through everything you've been through and to deconstruct everything that is bothering you? So there is no one size fits all, but I would just say follow your intuition. You always know what you need. And I would say that no one else can tell you what to do, and no one else could possibly understand you better than you. You know what you need.
It's all exploration.
Yeah. And that's the answer to everything. Everything is within. Yeah. And once you figure that out, then you can go get help, or you can read a book. But if you're trying to find the answer externally, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
I can tell you that right now. Because even if you go to a therapist and you're expecting them to fix you, it won't happen.
You get as much out of it as you put into it. Yeah.
So like, a good therapist always redirects the conversation back to the person. And it's the person doing the work, not the therapist. They can only guide. So that's how you can tell who's a good therapist or not, right? Based on like, are they just trying to fix you themselves, or are they actually
their opinion about your life, or are they
right? That's
yeah.
They're supposed to be a mirror more than anything else, and my book is a mirror more than anything else. It's not the Bible. It's not the truth. It helps point you to your own truth, which is within you.
And you say that within the book. You know, you say it's not the first text to cover this topic, but your approach to it is, I think, you know, very genuine and unique because of how simple it is. One of, this is where I knew we weren't going to have enough time, but,
I'm not on any time limit. It's just, so if you do have a time limit, then it's no problem too, but yeah.
So when it comes to, and this is very timely, cause obviously we're coming up to the New Year's, you know, one of the things you talk about is, well, in the absence of thought, can you really still set goals? And then you sort of follow it up with, there's a difference between setting goals out of inspiration versus setting goals out of desperation. And it's, you know, it's difficult because, you know, the knowing which is which can get murky. And I can only imagine, you know, it's, and I was thinking back to your you know, when you were talking about your childhood and growing up, and, you know, I don't know how you set goals not out of desperation when your parents are in $1 million of debt, right? So can you just talk a little bit more about, you know, the setting goals and setting them in inspiration versus desperation?
Yes. So I think we all start out setting goals from desperation, because we desperately want to live. We want to survive. We want to achieve. We want to accomplish. I think that's inevitable and unavoidable. So whenever I mention that, we've already been doing that for our whole lives. And so we know what that's like. We know how that feels. It, when we set a goal out of that, it always feels very heavy. It feels like a chore. It feels painful. The journey becomes, we really resent the journey to wherever we're trying to go. And so that's you can kind of see it apparent in the hustle culture, right? Just always looking towards that next goalpost, that next end, whatever it is we're trying to achieve. And that can work to make progress, but will it bring us happiness? That's a totally different question. So why set the goal in the first place is really what I'm trying to dig at when I'm proposing this idea. Most of the time when we're doing that, we're coming out of fear. And when we do things out of fear, it only perpetuates that feeling. So when I'm saying create goals out of desperation or create goals out of inspiration, it's really looking at what brings you joy in life, what actually brings you peace, as opposed to what's the external thing that I can accomplish that I think will give me happiness.
I'm excited to go reset some goal. Even when you talked about, it's just such a shift. And it's funny because some of the most profound truths are so simple.
That's all it is.
What do I want to be doing on a daily basis that brings me happiness? Like that's how I can set my goals, not like, I guess. Yeah. As a follow-up question to that, is how do you make sure that you're, and maybe this is just the wrong way of thinking about it, but how are you marking, progress? Like what is
measuring it?
Yeah. In the absence of some big goal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is when, so you can kind of see how all the philosophies start to intersect at this point. And it's really cool because it becomes very practical. So when we're thinking of creating goals out of inspiration, what I'm essentially doing is I'm bypassing needing to achieve whatever thing in the future to feel happy now. That's what I'm trying to do. Because if I'm foregoing my happiness now for some sort of hypothetical future, I'm never, ever going to be happy in the present moment. And most of our lives, well, not most, all of our lives are lived in the present moment. So our entire existence becomes a means to an end, which this is why we all feel so empty when we're setting goals out of desperation and just constantly trying to achieve, but to what end? So if we're achieving for the sake of achieving, it always feels unfulfilling. So that's why it's important to look at what actually, because what's the point of money anyway? Let's say money is a very big external goal that we all want. What's the point of money? Is it to actually have that cash in hand? No one cares about the piece of paper. It's what the money can do for you, but more specifically, how you think that thing will make you feel. We want that Rolls Royce or Rolex to feel what? To feel a specific emotion. We want to feel proud. We want to feel successful. We want to feel happy. Everything that we ever want in life is actually a feeling. It's not a thing. So then if that's true, right, we want a lot of money to have security, to feel safe. So we want a partner to feel love. So if that's true, is it possible to feel that emotion now without needing the external stimulus? And that's what I was trying to get to. And I realized that it is possible. And then it's a matter of, okay, if it is possible to feel happiness and to feel love and joy now, how and what do I need to do? And so, well, one, it's letting go of a lot of the thinking that's causing the harm. But two, what's the actual thing that you would do? And I think I asked this question in the book too, where it's like, if you had all the money in the world, all the money, unlimited money, already traveled the world, didn't receive any recognition for what you did, and had no fear, what would you do or what would you create? That question is very powerful because it removes all external reasons you would do something for, which means the thing that you're doing is no longer a means to an end. It's an end in and of itself. You do it because you love it.
Yeah.
You do it because it's fun.
Yeah.
And when you're doing that, it is by far the most powerful place you can create from. And that's how you creates external success, because it's impossible to ignore someone who is doing what they love and sharing it with the world at scale. Impossible. Like success is inevitable at that point. That's why I wrote the book. That's why anyone does anything at any massive level. Artists keep doing it, not because of the money or the fame. Like they just love painting. And the greatest ones will tell you after they accomplish whatever, you know, massive thing, they're like, I'm going to go paint again. I'm going to go make the thing again. I think like Phineas, a musician or an artist, he won like a Grammy or something like that. And then they asked him like, what are you going to do next? Like with all this money, he's like, I'm going to go write another song. Like that's all I'm going to do. So like, that's how you know you found your thing, that you would do it for fun. If you wouldn't get paid, you would just do it just because you love it. And if you can tie that in with something where you can share it with the world, and you can make money doing anything nowadays, like literally anything. Yeah. So it's not about trying to find the vehicle that will make you the most money. It's about, can you find the thing that you love so much that you would do it without getting paid, and just doing it for as long as you possibly can, as much as you can, and putting that in the world. And that's how you attract that external success, because like everything in this world is energy. Love attracts love. So if you are doing what you love and you're putting it out there, you will also get a lot of love for it. And that's really the key, I think, to creating that goal out of inspiration. That's the best way I can explain it.
I have a dozen follow-up questions for you, but yeah. I think we're just going to have you on again at some point.
No problem. Yeah.
I think you and I could talk about this stuff for hours.
Yeah.
You know, for the person who's on their commute right now, I want to make sure they're able to finish this before they get to the office. So yeah, Joseph, such a pleasure getting to chat with you. I really appreciate you taking time. Any last piece of advice? And you've been kind enough to come back on again for us to talk about how you've been able to make it as such a successful author, even though that's not the goal, you know, that's not the goal working for on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, I know it's going to be really helpful for a lot of people who want to learn how you've been able to be, to get your work out to so many different people. Any last piece of advice you have for people listening to this?
Last piece of advice, just stop thinking so much. just stop thinking and just start living. Because if we're thinking too much, we're not actually being. We're not living.
Yeah.
We're just stuck in our heads.
We could have a whole different conversation about meditation, I feel like.
Yeah.
Where can people get the book and learn more about you?
Yeah, the easiest way is just go on Amazon. Just get it from Amazon. You can get it from our website too. So josephwynn.org. You can get it there and find me on YouTube as well if you want to connect with me. And then on Instagram as well. YouTube is just my first name, last name. Instagram, you could just type my first name, last name as well, and you'll probably find me.
Awesome. Really appreciate you, Joseph.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I know there's many other things you could have been doing during this time, and I hope you found this episode incredibly useful for you and your journey. And if you did, or if you have any feedback, I would love to hear that in a review on Apple. That would be fantastic, or anywhere else that you are listening to this show. So thank you. And if you're the type of listener that is also an author or looking to be an author soon, feel free to email me at alex@advancedamazonads.com. That's alex@advancedamazonads.com. And I'll add you to our weekly newsletter where I send out all of the best marketing tips I've ever heard from authors that I've had on this show and many of the authors that we work with. So I look forward to hearing from you if that's something you'd find useful. And either way, I look forward to having you back for our next episode.